Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Adam Bobek, and I'm a PhD candidate in cultural anthropology at the University of Leipzig. I am beyond excited to have Professor Michael Muhammad Knight on the show today to talk about his new book, Metaphysical Africa, Truth and Blackness in the Ansaru Law Community. Michael Muhammad Knight is Assistant Professor of Religion and Cultural Studies at the University of Central Florida, and is the author of countless books, including The Five Percenters and Muhammad 40 Introductions. Today we're talking about Metaphysical Africa, published in 2020 with the Pennsylvania State University Press. Professor Knight, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. This is so awesome. I really appreciate this.
Can you tell us why you decided to write this book?
It comes from a long, 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 long time of engaging this community. So I started collecting material from, you know, the Ansaru Law about 20 some years ago. And it came out of my work with the Five Percenters, my work with what might be clumsily called heterodox African-American Islam, you know, more broadly speaking. But it's very different from some of that previous work. So, you know, my work with the Five Percenters was very, very, very complicated in terms of, you know, my insider-outsider status. You know, I went into that community not really equipped or trained to think about, you know, not only the baggage that I was bringing into it, but also the way that the experience would transform me. And so, you know, I got to a point where, you know, I'd been so deep in Five Percenter narratives and community that I really didn't know if I was a Five Percenter or not. You know, I really had to think about that and how do I relate to this world? And whether or not there's, you know, a place for me in it, and there's definitely a place for it in me. With this community, it was more detached. It was more an engagement of a textual archive, which is one way to do it and certainly not the only way to do it. But it wasn't the intimate ethnographic project or you know, that kind of search for personal meaning that kicked off my work with the Five Percenters. It was in the course of my work with the Five Percenters and my fascination with Master Farad Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam, that I began to engage this community that had its own really, really compelling narratives about Farad Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad, and the Five Percenters and Islam more broadly. And I just kept gathering more and more and more and more material. And you know, 20 years later, I just have an office full of boxes of stuff marked Nuwabian or Ansar. In terms of why, so that's my personal engagement. Like that's how I came to find this community really compelling and, you know, something that drew my attention. Why I felt there needed to be this book was as I tried to engage the academic sources, they did a really bad job, you know, in general, because it's a vast corpus of materials. No one has seen all of it. I haven't seen all of it. There's just so much media out there, but even after spending 20 years collecting it, I don't have all of it. But academic work on this community really, really looked at them superficially. And So I have two real things that I'm doing with this book. Number one, they exist because they kind of disappeared from Islamic studies, the academic study of Islam in America. And I wanted to bring them back and say, this is something that if you're a scholar of American Islam, you need to know about this community. And number two, let's take them seriously. With this community, there's a really easy way to fall into the cult narrative that these are people who just blindly followed a charismatic trickster who was simply in it for his own personal gain and manipulated and exploited and abused them. And I am actually not, you know, saying anything to his sincerity one way or the other. I'm not his apologist or his defender or his cheerleader at all. But he is not the entirety of this community's story, that there are actually people who engaged this and found meaning in it and circulated those meanings and disseminated them and found truth in his literature. So when I'm looking at this media, you know, I'm looking at rational arguments, you know, not charisma, not, you know, his cult of personality, but his arguments with scripture, with history, with the traditions that people were already using, that were already resources in their lives, and saying, you know, there is a very surprising, to outsiders, like there's a very surprising amount of coherence and consistency to them.
Before we get into the community itself, I wanted to talk for a moment about the title. The title of the book is Metaphysical Africa. Why did you choose to call it Metaphysical Africa?
So in Catherine Albanese's book, Republic of Mind and Spirit, where she's looking at metaphysical religion, esotericism, quote unquote, New Age stuff in North America, she uses the term metaphysical Asia to think about the ways that practitioners and seekers imagined Asia in their minds as this land of spirituality, and the way that they used resources from Asian traditions in ways that may or may not have corresponded to the ways that actual living flesh and blood people in Asia were using these materials or thought about them. But the way that there's this metaphysical Asia that's kind of recreated in North America. And so there's something going on similarly with this community. There's a metaphysical Africa, the connections that they draw between Islam and Africanity, particularly at a time when, you know, there was this kind of polar division of anti-Muslim Afrocentrists and anti-Black Sunni revivalists, and they're finding this third way, and they're articulating Islam as uniquely, distinctly African, and also kind of constructing a Black African perennialism. You know, they're kind of creating, like, you know, there's this old saying of the diaspora creates the homeland, right? Like they're kind of constructing Africa as a land of spirituality and a center of gravity for Islam.
So now maybe the best place to start is with the leader. Can we, a man who goes by many names, can you give listeners a little bit of a background of him?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's really good to point out the issue of names. In my work with the Five Percenters, I'm very clear about when we can call the man Clarence and when we can't, you know, and 1964, there's a very clear break. His name is Allah. That's it. Don't call him Clarence. This is like a Malcolm Little, Cassius Clay kind of thing that you're doing if you call him Clarence. I try to have that same kind of faithfulness to letting people name themselves, or recognizing that people name themselves, rather, with the leader of this community. It's much more difficult because he did use multiple names, but consistently through the 70s and the 80s, he was Isa El Mahdi, popularly Imam Isa. He was born Dwight York. He would use that at some point later in the, you know, in the early 90s. But also he became really, really known as Malachi York, you know, post 93, early 90s, he became Malachi York. So he used a lot of different titles, a lot of different names, depending on the different resources that he was utilizing. You know, sometimes those would come with a new name or a new designation. So I often refer to him as York because this is the best we can do for historical consistency. And when I'm really into the Ansarul Allah period of his life, I tend to go Imam Isa or Al-Mahdi. Imam Isa Al-Mahdi, Al-Hadi Al-Mahdi was his name. So it gets messy. So if I'm talking about Al-Mahdi as a person, if I'm talking about York as a person, that's the same guy. That's a short answer to the question of names. But his background is a little mysterious. I think more of that will come out in the future. But he was a teenager at State Street Mosque, a very famous, historically significant institution in Brooklyn. And State Street Mosque, this is the 60s, State Street Mosque was a very diverse community. There were Black converts, you know, coming from different backgrounds. There were a number of transnational diasporic communities. Most significantly here, a Sudanese diaspora community that was really, really foundational for how young Dwight York, later Imam Isa, would think about Islam and Islam's relationship to Africa. Maryam Jamila was there. Maryam Jamila, I believe, took her shahada, you know, with the imam of that mosque. And there's just a lot going on. And there's significant tensions between some of these communities. So South Asian Muslims, Arab Muslims, African-American Muslims. This is an old story for people who study American Islam, that there's these questions of authenticity and authority. Who represents real Islam? And who has the authority to speak for it and make judgments on it and say who's doing it right and who's not. So he witnessed this as a young man. And he witnessed a tension between this discourse of Islam as Black power, Islam as Black liberation, as Black consciousness, Black knowledge of self. He had exposure to those kinds of narratives and that particular construction of Islam. But then he was also encountering anti-Black racism in Muslim spaces. And so I think this was very formative. You know, if we track his literature and his media through the next 30, 40 years, we see this ongoing expression of where Islam comes from, who rightfully owns it. Even after he stops identifying as a Muslim, he has this antagonism, you know, towards transnational Muslim communities, specifically the ones that he designates as pale Arab as opposed to Black Arab. And that would just be foundational to his life from that point forward. In the early 70s, around the turn of the 70s, he's engaging in what I called an Afrocentric Sufism, you know, a Sufism that was really informed by his encounter with the Sudanese community in Brooklyn. And he's going up and down the street, you know, with some of his cohort from the State Street Mosque, doing loud zikrs and, you know, having a talking drum, and they're living communally, and this grows. You know, he's a very voracious reader. He seems to be really, really devoted, autodidact. Very, very early on, he starts doing his own dawah, his own preaching, putting out his own publications, and it just grows. And by the end of the 70s, they're a really, really prominent presence in the Muslim landscape of New York and then the Northeast more broadly. And they'd even started going into the Caribbean and expanding there. His archive was very eclectic, and we'll talk about that. He gets into everything that's available to him. You know, there's a story that his mother was a member of the Yoruba temple. So he's into Yoruba revivalism. He has encounters with every kind of conceivable vision of Islam available to him in North America at that time. He's getting into Black Israelite stuff. He's getting into Egyptosophy. He's getting into all these resources. And he makes his own archive of materials that just kind of goes all over the place, but pulls it together at the same time. And To shorten this so we can get into, you know, where we want to go, this antagonism with other Muslim communities, particularly Sunni communities and transnational Sunni communities, as well as his opponents in African-American Islam, a number of factors get to a point where he increasingly relocates to a commune upstate. I say downstate still. It's upstate from New York, but it's still, you know, I'm a real upstater. If it's less than 2 hours away, you're not upstate. But, you know, he had this commune in the Catskills, and he would spend time there. And then in the early 90s, he moved to Georgia with, you know, kind of a mass exodus. Like, he makes this big hijra with his followers to rural Georgia. There with recognition that, you know, this, I'm going to unpack some of this. He gets more into Egyptosophy, more into extraterrestrial mythology and that kind of thing. And really detaches himself from overt Muslim identity. And he is now, at that ridiculous Maximax prison, Ultramax Maximax prison in, Colorado. His commune in Georgia was raided, you know, around the early 2000s, and he is officially it was like RICO kind of charges, but it was, you know, transporting minors for, you know, sexual abuse and that kinds of thing. So he is going to spend the rest of his life in this prison in Colorado. And yeah, we can get more into specifically, you know, how he read these materials and what he did, but that's where he's at now. So
yeah. Is there anything that we could say then about the Ansarullah community, before we get further into the interview?
Yeah. Yeah. So, the Ansarullah developed, you know, through the '70s, in the early '70s, early to mid '70s, he made York al-Mahdi. He made a journey to the Sudan and came back, you know, really identifying himself as a descendant of the Sudanese Mahdi, who had pushed out the British and the Egyptians, you know, in the 19th century and, you know, claimed to be the Mahdi, claimed to be the awaited person. And York latched onto this. And so he even, you know, named himself Isa al-Hadi al-Mahdi, you know, identifying with the Mahdi family, as his great-grandson. And this became part of that package where Islam becomes innately Nubian, Islam becomes Sudanese, Islam becomes African in his reimagining, or his repackaging of it in the North American context. This put him, so he had a way in this community of kind of answering every community that he was going to run into. So against Sunni Arab revivalists or Sunni transnational revivalists or Sunni black revivalists, he had this reorientation of Islam towards the Sudan that, no, you don't go to Saudi for your authenticity, go to the Sudan for your authenticity, to be authentically Muslim. To the Nation of Islam, he had very much, like, you know, mirroring Sunni revivalist critiques of the Nation. He's like, you don't know real Islam, you don't have Arabic, you don't read the Quran the right way, you don't engage the Hadiths the right way, you don't know all this, you know, intellectual tradition stuff, you don't have a connection to, you know, the heartland of Islam, the Sudan. So he could answer everyone, you know, on their own terms. And he had something for Black Israelites. He presented himself as a devoted, you know, as a scholar of both Arabic and Hebrew. And that was very important to his self-presentation. The Ansarullah identified itself as, there's kind of a Black perennialism going on, you know, like a comprehensive engagement of all these traditions. They argued, you know, that the Quran tells you to follow the laws of Moses and read the books of Moses. Conversely, they would say the seventh seal in Revelation is the Quran, and the Injil mentioned in the Quran is the book of Revelation. And so they have this circular intertextuality thing happening where, to be a true Muslim, you have to honor the Sabbath, you have to follow the laws of the Israelites, you have to be versed in the book of Revelation. So that they could say to Muslims, you don't read the Bible. They could say to Jews and Christians, you don't understand that Jesus is telling you to read the Quran. So he mastered a very deep archive of material. And he could answer everybody. You know, he had something for everyone. So, you know, his community would be, you know, having their tables out on the street, you know, in Harlem and Brooklyn. And if you were interested in Islam, they had that. If you were interested in Black Israelite stuff, they had that. If you, you know, depending on what version of Islam you wanted, they could speak to you. And they produced a massive, massive corpus of literature, to kind of meet everyone where they were. And, you know, the scholarship on this community really didn't know what to do with that. So we get different narratives of, what their trajectory was. You know, did they start out Muslim and then became Black Israelite or Black Hebrew? Was it the other way around? Did they become Christian at one point? Did they become Shia at one point? Did they become more Sunni than they had been? Did they abandon Islam altogether? I've seen like every possible way that this story could be told. And I think it's just based on, you know, the very select reading list that someone has. Okay, well, the copyright on this very Sunni sounding book is earlier than this very Christian sounding book. So they must have gone from Sunni to Christian. Excuse me. And it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So I have boxes and boxes and boxes in this office here that just make that so much more complicated than someone might take it to be. Even, you know, as we move into the 90s, you know, his anti-Sunni antagonism really becomes like overtly a severe detachment from Muslim identity. He goes through what people call a Jewish phase, and I really challenge that. And I can say why that's a troubled reading, even though they kind of retroactively say this for themselves, but they weren't saying it at the time. And then, you know, like I said, you know, in Georgia, they go full Egyptosophy and UFOs and all of that. But again, you know, when I'm looking at their material from the early 70s and the 80s, like it all to me reads as one archive. There is like an internal continuity to it that if you're really willing to spend time with this media, that really kind of manifests.
Yeah. So going back to the 70s and 80s, can you maybe talk a little bit about how the community related to other African-American Muslim organizations, like the Moorish Science Temple, the Nation of Islam, the Five Percenters, et cetera?
Yeah. So first on the point of, you know, what we might, again, these are clumsy terms. We can trouble these terms, but, you know, heterodox African-American Islamic traditions, Nation of Islam, Moorish Science, Five Percenters. I would call it a kind of polemical embrace. So this community would publish the Nation of Islam's lessons and publish the Moorish Science Temple Quran, the Circle 7 Quran. And they would publish these very... It looks like a tribute. It looks like, you know, a celebration of this person's contribution, Elijah Muhammad, Noble Drew Ali, the former Clarence 13X, Allah. But when you get in there, when you get into the text, there is kind of a polemic happening where, okay, to the members of this community, you know, you bought this book, you know, you care about Elijah Muhammad, you care about Noble Drew Ali. Number one, they weren't qualified to really teach Islam. Number two, if they were here, they would be following me because they knew this themselves. And Elijah Muhammad prophesied my coming, and Noble Drew Ali said there would be one who could teach real Islam, and so on and so forth. What we all need to do is come together in unity. And unity in this case means following him, right? Subscribing to his authority that Elijah Muhammad foretold his coming. he had really, really complex conspiracy theory kind of narratives. So he had an evolving story about Farad Muhammad, the founder of the Nation of Islam, that, you know, the government had killed the real Farad and replaced him with this fake Farad. And, you know, Elijah Muhammad, he has an undying love for Elijah Muhammad that's consistent through every stage of his mission. He loves and admires and claims the mantle of Elijah Muhammad. But he also believes that Elijah Muhammad was very limited. He was following the fake Farad. And Elijah didn't have Arabic, and Elijah didn't have classical training, and so on and so forth. But Elijah was preparing the stage for York, for Al-Mahdi to come. Elijah Muhammad understood that someone, that he was just making the table. He was just putting the plate down, and someone else is going to bring the food. There's this narrative that Elijah Muhammad had a vision of the letter Lam, the Arabic letter Lam, and the way that York would read this vision, you know, he had a hooked staff that looked like the letter Lam. And he would say, you know, this came to me, you know, this was handed down to me, you know, through Kither, you know, the teacher of Moses, through the prophets, through, you know, this at one point was in the hands of Bilal, the Ethiopian companion of the prophet who was a true Israelite. And Bilal came to bring this hooked scepter to Muhammad as a union of the Israelites and Muhammad's Ishmaelite heritage, And that's been passed down to me. And Elijah told you that I was coming with this. That's what the letter Lamb is. It was very creative. It was brilliant. There's something addictive about the literature. There's something really compelling about it. He places himself in Malcolm X's autobiography. He says that he taught Malcolm X. You know, he was part of, you know, when Malcolm goes on Hajj and doesn't know how to do the things, that York is there and he's the one who's, you know, helping Malcolm out. Excuse me. And he has a narrative of Malcolm being, you know, a victim of the Saudi state, that they took him, they got what they wanted from him, and then they killed him. So he has this way of co-opting these different traditions within the milieu of African-American Islam and bringing it all together. And even, you know, he goes in, he does the same thing with Black Hebrews, Black Israelite movements, Marcus Garvey, says Marcus Garvey was a Muslim, brings it all under his umbrella. That if you really love these people, if you really identify all of this as your narrative, your story, your collective struggle, you will find its culmination in him. And he also, he had something for Black Sunnis also. So his answer to Black Sunnis was, you know, to, he says, you know, when Elijah Muhammad says the white man's a devil, he was right. He didn't get the full truth of it. He didn't understand why, but he was right in saying that. And York, as Mahdi, he projects this onto the early history of Islam. So the original Muslim community, the followers of the Prophet, are divided between pale Arabs and black Arabs. And the Prophet himself is a black Arab. Abu Bakr and Aisha are pale Arabs. And they engage in this hostile takeover of Islam after the Prophet's death. So Ali and Fatima have to flee. They flee with the real Quran. They flee with it to the Sudan, where it's going to be preserved through the centuries. And Al-Mahdi, York, he has this reading of the schisms and the power struggles and the factionalism in early Islam through this racial lens, you know, through this through Elijah Muhammad's understanding that the white people are devils. So if you are looking to Saudi Arabia as the center of gravity, as the place where you go for the authentic and the authoritative, if you are going to follow what he called Pakistanians, who he identified as pale Arabs, who are white people in his categories, they are white people. You have been deceived by the shaitan, by the devil, because Islam is black. Islam is Nubian. Islam comes from the Sudan. Islam was preserved in the Sudan by the Prophet's family. And the Prophet's family fled Muslim persecution, found their refuge in the Sudan. And, you know, with this kind of encroaching Saudi-driven Sunni global Sunni revivalism that the Waruddin Muhammad community, you know, post Elijah's death is taking part in, benefiting from, engaging in different ways, York has this way of saying, you know, black Sunnis are puppets of this pale Arab Saudi takeover, that pale Arab Saudi Sunni Islam is the same as white supremacist Christianity. And meanwhile, you know, there have been efforts within American Islam to recover Islam's blackness, Noble Drolli, Elijah Muhammad, and they all meant well, but they couldn't do it. I have the real thing. So again, like he can take on black Sunnis, he can take on Nation of Islam, more science, but then he can also take on anti-Muslim Afrocentrists, you know, what Sherman Jackson called black Orientalism. You know, this Afrocentric critique of Islam as Arab hegemony imposed upon Africa. York would say, like, no, you're kind of right, but not entirely. Like, Islam is black. Don't look at the pale Arabs as being the representatives of Islam. Islam is yours. So it was really just a brilliant, brilliant series of what I would call polemical embraces of these different traditions and communities.
Yeah, in the book, you discuss how he was able to navigate between the two strands of the Nation of Islam that developed, and how he was in constant kind of polemical discourse with Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam specifically, right? And at one point, he publishes a polemic against them, and then he issues an apology, and then he withdraws the apology. Could you maybe get into that a little bit?
Because I found that
super interesting.
I think I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think it speaks to the complexity of how he engages these groups. Because like I said, he had this conspiracy theory about Farad. You know, he had this idea that there were multiple Farads, and, you know, at one point Farad's a Nazi, and at one point Farad is a CIA agent, and it goes kind of all over the place. And sometimes he has photo evidence that he presents, is that, oh, here's the real Farad and here's the fake Farad. His mentor, Sheikh Dawood at State Street, sometimes he would cite as an authority on this. So he presents this narrative about Farad, and there was some trouble with the Nation of Islam. You know, they took offense to this. And he published an apology to the followers of Elijah Muhammad, to the Nation of Islam. What's interesting here is that he doesn't say, okay, I've been pressured to do this. I've been intimidated. I realized I kind of overstepped. I was wrong. I mean, you know, it is an apology, but he's not giving the credit, or he's not attributing this to the nation itself. He's saying, Elijah Muhammad spoke to me in a dream and told me what's what. So he still has this very intimate connection to Elijah. You know, if you look at the late 70s, you know, Elijah really wasn't on his radar before he died. He was arguing more with Black Sunni groups. But post 75, really post 78, when Farrakhan is reviving the original nation, York becomes increasingly interested in this tradition, but he's like a third party in New York and the, you know, broader Northeast, because Waruddin Muhammad, you know, contrary to the way people usually read that history, like Elijah dies, Elijah's son Waruddin takes over, and then just flips a switch and everybody's Sunni. Waruddin Muhammad did a really complex navigation, you know, and he was speaking from a place as the charismatic, mystical heir to his father. He couldn't have undid that if he didn't have it already. You know, he had to speak as the one who was the special one, the next one coming, you know, the Mujaddid, as he called himself. So he's doing that. Like he's speaking from a place of authority as heir to that tradition. Louis Farrakhan would make an alternate claim to be the heir of that tradition. And so York puts his hat in the ring and says, you know, no, it's mine. You know, I'm the one that Elijah foretold. So that was the context, and he really never lets go of Elijah, even at his most overtly, and I say overtly because it's more complicated, but his most overtly anti-Muslim stuff, he's sticking to Elijah as like the greatest leader that Black America ever had.
So you've touched on this a little bit, and I think this is the point where we can really get into it. The community, as a lot of people see it, goes through a number of changes, right? Especially in the early 90s. And this has led a lot of people to argue that the community has some unstable or incoherent core to it, and it just does whatever the leader says. Can you talk about why you challenge that reading?
Yeah, I mean, first, I think a lot of it is just kind of ahistorical. So again, they put out a lot of literature. I don't want to be too, you know, snarky about people not reading all of it, because there's a lot of it. It's hard to find, and you get what you get. You know, we're all just grabbing the part of the elephant that we're grabbing, you know, with this massive archive. But people have tried to trace a trajectory of, oh, first they called themselves Hebrews, and then they called themselves Muslims. And like I said, you know, it goes in every direction. You know, the number of different trajectories that people have claimed for this community. And that feeds into an image of them as this unstable, unthinking, incoherent, and, you know, I don't use this word in classroom, but cult, you know, that they are just brainwashed, blindly following this guy who just on a whim says, okay, now we're Jews. Nope, now we're Muslims. Now we're UFOs. That's not what happened. That's not what happened. These people knew that they were on a journey, and they understood that journey in different ways at different times. You know, sometimes retroactively, they read it differently than they did when they were going through it, but they rationalized these changes that they went through. And they did go through changes. I don't deny that they went through changes, but they rationalized these changes within their pre-existing pool of resources that they had. So, you know, one narrative is that around the turn of the 90s, York just suddenly became a rabbi and said, okay, we're Jews now. They didn't actually claim to be Jews, but like that, they're really emphasizing their Jewishness. And sometimes retroactively, it's called a Jewish phase or a Jewish period in their history. If you look at what they were actually saying during that time, they were saying Muhammad was a Hebrew. Muhammad was a Hebrew, and he followed the laws of Moses. The Quran tells you to read the previous scriptures. And the problem isn't that they're Muslims or not Muslims. The problem is the Muslim world has erased this part of its own territory, its own heritage, that people wanted to create a distinct different religion when the Quran says, you know, all the prophets are doing the same thing, right? They understood it in their own terms. They held on to Muhammad. You know, they did different things with him, and they're very creative. The media is very creative in its use of Muhammad, but they said, this is what we're truer to Muhammad than you are. Likewise, you know, other materials that we often think of as representing distinct stages, like, okay, suddenly they got into extraterrestrials in the early 90s. He claimed to have come from a different galaxy in 1983. You know, that's the earliest I found. There could be a text earlier than that. He was doing stuff with ancient Egypt way, 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 way before he suddenly became this pharaoh figure. You know, that was part of his engagement of the Sudan. You know, he was talking about pyramids. He was talking about pharaohs. He was talking about, you know, ancient Nubia. He was saying that, you know, Ishmael's mother was, you know, born into Egyptian royalty, you know, or the Egyptian priesthood. It was all there. He has Abraham hanging out with Imhotep way, 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 way back, right? So it wasn't suddenly, now we're into ancient Egypt. It was always there. And when he decided to place new emphasis on a certain aspect of their material, it didn't come out of left field. It wasn't random. It wasn't this bewildering, quote unquote, holy madness that some scholarship has called it. Like, that they're just so awestruck by his charisma that they're just going to follow these complete 180s. They weren't 180s. They were inside the same pool for most of their history.
In the book, you use the metaphor of a discursive control panel with multiple dials that were turned up and turned down at various points. I think that's a brilliant metaphor.
Thanks.
So the Ansar Allah community, right, they make use of various religious traditions, right? Judaism, Christianity, Islam, UFO religion, Egyptosophy, etc., right? But you also make a really, I think, interesting argument that it's not productive to consider this syncretism.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Speaking to the control panel, you know, it's not that to turn one dial up turns the other dial off, right? They are all, and it's not that you only have this one panel, and if you want to do other stuff, you have to go to the other panel. Like, it's all the same panel. We all draw these categories in different ways. We have a sense of what looks Islamic to us, what looks Jewish to us, what's recognizably inside a tradition to us. But we have to recognize that those boundaries aren't at the same places everywhere. So if we look at the history of the Nation of Islam and Black Sunnis, these aren't two separate worlds that have nothing to do with each other. And Black Israelites, like, there's so much exchange and encounter, and, you know, the mixture is there before anyone is worried about mixture, right? So he didn't go from Islam to Egypt or blend in Egyptosophy into Islam. Elijah Muhammad was interested in Egypt. Elijah Muhammad was talking about UFOs. Elijah Muhammad was talking about Freemasonry. All these different things that we think of as non-Islamic stuff that he brought in from outside. And he's this master mixer who's just stirring the pot with all these ingredients that have had nothing to do with each other prior to him. Freemasonry, Pharaonic Egypt, Hebrews, extraterrestrial spaceship stuff that was all part of Islam before he got there. He's not going outside of Islam to find it. His experience as a Muslim opened doors maybe for him to go deeper into Egyptosophy and go elaborate, you know, find new readings on UFOs that are coming from non-Muslim authors. But it starts in Islam for him. All of that's Islamic material. So, you know, syncretism, you know, just this idea that someone starts out with these very distinct ordered categories and then decides to willfully just at random sometimes just choose to mix and match them. It doesn't necessarily meet what we see on the ground. And sometimes this community will retroactively talk about having passed through distinct categories. Oh, we were Muslim and we were Jewish and we've always been Christian. I've seen the claim that we've always been Christian. But I think it's really important to look at what they're saying in a particular moment, because there's no point at which he says, I'm going to take some stuff out of Judaism and put it in here, or we're leaving Islam and we're going through a Jewish stuff right now. We're going to have a Jewish phase for a while, and then we're going to go through another phase. He never does that, and he never has to. And it's never that these things are alien or foreign, or coming from outside Islam. It's already, when he says, I'm a rabbi, and he says, we're going to really push the Hebrew right now, that wasn't coming from outside Islam. He's been saying that was part of Islam for 20 years, before that moment. I think these traditions are always defined by mixture and by, stirring up with what's outside, but it's not so clear cut. And the way that an outsider might think of Islam and Judaism and Freemasonry, et cetera, may not be the way that it looks to people on the inside.
And you've talked a little bit about this already, but could you maybe speak more to the role of language in the community of Arabic and Hebrew and then eventually Nuwabic?
Yeah. So Arabic was super, super, super important for a number of reasons, through much of the community's history. It was a marker of authenticity and a marker of authority. Those two things we keep running into over and over again. Authenticity, what makes someone a legitimate Muslim? What gives someone a legitimate knowledge of Islam? And, there's been a lot of scholarship on the significance of what Arabic does, particularly in communities where everyone doesn't speak Arabic, right? So if you're, in a Muslim community that doesn't have Arabic as a first language, for someone to walk in and have that represent something, even, the early nations. So Farad was teaching from an Arabic Quran. Like, he had to mediate between the Quran and his audience, and that really authorized Farad, the impression that he was the master interpreter of this other language. So the Ansarullah very early on emphasized, not only do you have to, study Arabic to properly understand the scriptures, but they were boasting that they were creating the society that movements such as the Nation of Islam and Moorish Science Temple had attempted to but failed, because they were raising their children speaking Fusha in the house, that their children had classical Arabic as their first language. That's when they're at the dinner table with their family, that's what they're speaking. And this was a real mark of pride for the community. They embodied their understanding of Islam in ways such as dress and, gender relations, and language was such a huge part of it. And they could say, look, Elijah didn't have it. Elijah had this vision of the letter lamb. He didn't know what to do with that. Five percenters, they say Allah means arm, leg, leg, arm, head, but that doesn't work in Arabic. Why are you using the devil's language to say what Allah is? And even Sunnis, like you would say, Warathin doesn't have my Arabic. Warathin doesn't have my tools for understanding the scripture. Farrakhan doesn't have any Arabic. So he could weaponize Arabic. And then in turn, he would weaponize Hebrew, because the Sunni Arabs that he's arguing against aren't working with Hebrew. So he's like, look, you have to know all the scriptures, all the languages. You can't read the scriptures unless you understand the languages of God. So he really, really, in particular, Arabic was a very powerful resource for him. Later on, and we can chart, an ongoing escalating antagonism with other Muslim communities through the 80s that ultimately kind of leads to where we end up in the 90s. But he began to emphasize a very particular, what he presented as a Sudanese, as an authentic Nubian Arabic, and that kind of moved into its own language. So he has this Nuwabic language that is kind of like, everything that Arabic did for his authenticity and his authority against other Muslim groups, Nuwabic just kind of takes them into another galaxy, like literally into another galaxy in a sense. The narrative I've heard about Nuwapik, and if you read Arabic, you can look at Nuwapik and make some sense of it. Or I mean, he starts out with Nubik, which is like a very, like, it looks Arabic-ish to me. Like I can see some of it and then make educated guesses about letters that aren't clear. But Nuwapik would, you know, kind of also reflect his later development, his developing Egyptosophy and things like that. But one narrative that I've seen was that Nuwapik actually developed among children in his community who had a hybrid language that they spoke. I mean, so again, this is a community that just embraces Fusha as their first language. So all the funky things you see happen with language, like, that is going to happen here. So in the early 90s with the upstate community, downstate, you know, the upstate community, kids are speaking to each other in a language that incorporates Arabic, English, and Spanish. So for example, if the KBR root would mean like great, they would say greater would be Akbar, but then greatest would be Kaburist. So their superlatives would be this kind of hybrid of English and Arabic. And so York found that really interesting, that they kind of developed their own language. And, you know, we can speak to, you know, I can't really speak to his sincerity or his intentions at this point, but he embraced that. He embraced what they were doing.
Could we maybe talk for a moment about the relationship then also between the community and hip hop, as you get into in the book?
Yeah. So the Islam and hip hop conversation, which I have a little bit of, you know, based on the stuff that I work on, like there's this Sunni co-opting of the Islam and hip hop discourse. And I feel very wary of calling it a co-opting, because like I don't want to tell, and I can't tell communities how to make sense of the things that are valuable to them, right? But as someone who finds these traditions valuable, sometimes I take a little bit of umbrage at the ways that they're erased from it or kind of consumed within this hegemonic Sunni re-inscription. So, you know, several years ago, I caught a glimpse of a project that was like an Islam and hip hop project. It was called Rakim to Rumi or something like that. And, you know, I knew some of the people involved and I like and respect those people, but there was this way that hip hop was being read as innately Islamic in a way that would satisfy post Elijah American Islam, you know, a very war-themed kind of, you know, Sunni rewriting. And people are talking about the Islam in Rakim, who's a 5%er, right? So they're talking about Islam in Rakim, and they don't say his name was Rakim Allah. Like, that was his name. He was Rakim Allah, and he was Allah, and he was God. And that was what Islam said to him. That's what Islam meant for him. So I like emphasizing that. You know, we see scholarship in this material that talks about knowledge of self as this innately, you know, that this inherent part of Black Islamic tradition in the Americas. And knowledge of self meant that you're God, you know, and we erase that. And I understand like traditions change and traditions develop and people decide what parts are useful to them or not. So it's certainly not my territory and my property to get in the way of that. But as someone who really kind of went into those traditions without them needing to end up Sunni, you know, I wish sometimes that we had more, that some of the things that we washed out of these traditions that we don't. So the Ansar, they don't have the prolific presence in hip hop that the 5%ers did, but there were numerous artists who affiliated with them. Most importantly, the Jazz, who was, you know, Jay-Z's mentor and someone who, so you can look up the Jazz and Jay-Z, the originators, on YouTube and find this video where a very, very, very young Jay-Z is in Brooklyn with the Ansars. And very, very, very like just adjacent to that community and even making references in his part of the song to Ansar racial mythology of Amorites and Nubians and and that kind of thing. So it was there. And York himself had he was an aspiring music mogul in addition to all this other stuff that he was doing. And he had this alternate persona of Dr. York. So before he called himself Dr. Malachi York in his religious discourse, he was Dr. York, the entertainer, a singer and a record producer and the owner of his own label, York Records in Brooklyn, that worked with all kinds of people. He was trying to promote his own kind of roster of artists. He worked with African Bambaataa, and Dr. York wasn't a secret. So if you look at the pictures of Imam Isa al-Hadi al-Mahdi and the pictures of Dr. York, and Dr. York's putting out a Christmas album and Imam Isa is saying Christmas is the devil. And, you know, like it might look like, it might be a weird look to outsiders, you know, but there are convert narratives where people knew him as Dr. York first. They're like, oh yeah, I knew Dr. York's music. And then I found out, oh, he's a scholar of religion, you know? So it wasn't like he had this secret persona or this contradiction that people just couldn't wrap their heads around. He talked about it in his literature. He said, you know, I have to meet people where they are. If people aren't ready for Islam, people aren't ready for someone wearing a turban and a robe. That was like their garb at the time. He's like, I got to meet them as Dr. York. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be Dr. York and I'm going to bring them into Islam. And actually some people did come to Islam through Dr. York. So there's a rich tradition of, you know, this community intersecting with music, and York pretty consistently throughout his history, was an anti-music. You know, he treated music like language, like clothing. You know, there's a right way to do it, a wrong way to do it, and don't do it the devil's way to do it. Do it the right Islamic way and Islamic music, Islamic instruments and stuff. And Dr. York didn't subscribe to that and his Dr. York persona. But again, that was to open the door, as he presented it, was to open the door for other people to come in.
I would consider this interview a failure if I did not ask you about your visits to the Georgia compound that you write about. You don't write about it in this book, but you do write about it in your other book, one of your many other books, Blue Eyed Devil. Could you talk about that for our listeners?
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because, you know, I knew I was going to forget. So in 2003, I was on this project of, I wanted to tell the story of American Islam in a kind of superficial, I don't know if it's superficial to me, but in a very, you know, firsthand, I'm going to go out on the road and experience it and witness it with all my limitations and opportunities and what have you. And I really centered that on the question of Master Farad Muhammad, you know, the founder of the nation, who was very enigmatic, very mysterious. We still don't know everything we want to know about him. You know, he escaped history, really. And so part of that led me to the, like I said earlier, you know, the really, really developed conspiracy theory kind of narratives that York put out. So I tried to go to the commune in Georgia. It's a really, you know, it's been torn down. It was a really, really compelling aesthetic. You know, they had what you could call a pyramid shaped Kaaba, you know, and it just blew my mind. You know, the kinds of creativity witnessed in this community, it was pretty awesome. I didn't get to go in, and this was after he'd been arrested. So there was a very clear suspicion of outsiders, and I really didn't get anything out of it because I just drove by, and I didn't have the resources intellectually at that time to question, to rethink the cult narrative. And when I say rethink the cult narrative, question the cult narrative, I'm not saying that I'm trying to defend him or, you know, rehabilitate his image or anything like that. Like, I'm not interested in him as a person. People made meaning from this body of literature. People found truth in it. That truth led them in all kinds of different directions. He's kind of an assemblage. Like, he didn't even necessarily write every word that he wrote. Like, I know survivors of his abuse who said that they wrote much of that material. But I wasn't, you know, we have a tendency to think of these communities squarely, entirely in terms of their, you know, their quote unquote evil mastermind, charismatic manipulator, leader. And I wasn't prepared to go beyond that. I saw them as just brainwashed cult fanatic type people, you know, and it was through years and years and, you know, the experience of going to graduate school and doing the academic study of religion and knowing scholars of new religious movements who will, you know, walk you through the cult narrative, and you won't say the word cult anymore. You know, like I've had that journey, and just looking at the complexity of their literature over the course of many, many years of going to their stores in New York and going to their tables. And, there's just so much more to this archive, this corpus that defies so much of that narrative. And it was really regrettable to me the way that academic literature kind of took part and enforced that, oh, they're so unstable and crazy and weird, and they just switch religions constantly, and they just follow this guy doing whatever. And, you know, just seeing what had been missed and seeing what had been ignored and neglected and misread to my eyes, that really became the engine for this project. You know, after they moved to Georgia, they really became a new religious movement topic, and they fell out of Islamic studies. So, like, you know, Islamic studies in the 90s and the 80s, like, you will find them mentioned. You will find them getting a page, maybe a chapter. Like, they don't get a ton of deep attention, but they're recognized as something that exists. And their existence kind of stops when they get into other stuff. And we leave out the way that Islam remained a salient resource for them through those years. So I really wanted to bring them back into Islamic studies. And, you know, I made a dramatic statement in one of my writings on them, not this book necessarily, but I say that Malachi York, a.k.a. Imam Isa al-Hadi al-Mahdi, was the most significant American Sufi leader in the 20th century. And I stand by that. I stand by that. He did have a Sufi tariqa that was part of the community. It was adjacent to the community, Sons of the Green Light. And the study of American Sufism says nothing about him. There's numerous publications on American Sufis. He's never counted. His community is never counted. Even when, you know, they were identifying as Sufis. It's, you know, he didn't have, you know, I mean, if you're Frithjof Schwann or Baba Mohiyadin, you have academics who are your followers, and they will put your name out there, and the story of American Sufism will be your story. He didn't have that. York didn't have that advantage. And I'm not saying that York as a human being deserved, you know, any kind of moral or ethical sense that he deserved that attention. I mean, we could also talk about Frithjof Schwann, you know, on that level. But for a number of reasons, you know, that number one, the study of American Sufism is still catching up to recognizing that, you know, Black Muslims are part of Sufism, and that Sufism is part of Black Islam, and that these categories don't have these absolute borders between them that we think they do. So number one, study of American Sufism still has to think more about Black religion than it has. And, you know, the study of this community has to recognize what's there. The study of American Islam more broadly has to recognize what's there and take these things seriously.
So there's one last tradition for the New Books Network, which is, what are you working on now?
I appreciate that. I really appreciate this opportunity. I know, like, talking about this community can go in so many different directions, and I feel like I do go in a lot of different directions, and I'm really grateful for the chance. If it's hard sorting me out, like, talking about it, like, it's hard sorting out this material. Like, again, there's a lot of it. But anyway, where I'm going now, I'm working on a few things. I'm working on the lessons, popularly known as the Supreme Wisdom Lessons, the Catechism of the Nation of Islam. I spent a lot of time on that, and so that should manifest in the next year or so. I'm also, you know, I have a few things at different stages of development. I'm working on my Islamic engagement of Deleuze, which, you know, Deleuze was part of my dissertating process and part of my book, Muhammad's Body. So the book is called Muhammad's Body, you know, prophetic networks and the Baraka networks and the prophetic assemblage. I'm messing up my own title, but the word assemblage is in the title. So it's like, you see the doulas, it's there. I talk about the Nabi without organs, the NWO, which was my way of smuggling pro wrestling references into my work. So I have a book on doulas. I have a book on the lessons, and I'm presently going back into the quote unquote classical stuff. And I'm working on a book on the prophet, which I think is, you know, really an ongoing journey with me of what does this man mean to me personally? And that I think informs every day of my life as an academic. So I'm going back into there and, you know, reconsidering my journey and rethinking the state of the field. And, you know, like the personal and the academic, it's not getting untangled for any of us. Definitely not for me. So I'm doing some me search there, as we say. But yeah, so I have three things coming out: the lessons, the Luz, and Muhammad.
Wonderful.
At point in the next 2 years.
Inshallah,
we can get you back. And then I don't know what happens, because I've been kind of obsessed with a book one way or the other for 20 years now. I wrote The Taco Horrors in the winter of 2002. So I don't know what's next, and I might get weird again. I don't know. That's a possibility, because sometimes I miss being weird, you know, like I haven't had any kind of ayahuasca journeys or anything like that. So maybe it's time to do something that's not peer reviewed.
Inshallah, we can get you back on for that as well.
Thank you. That'd be great.
The book is Metaphysical Africa, published in 2020 with the Pennsylvania State University Press. Professor Michael Muhammad Knight, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. This is awesome.